when we reconnected and got these tapes out of the garages that they were in, dusted them off and got them mixed down, you can imagine the feeling we had. You know, it's pretty I mean, time capsule absolute.
It's really weird when I was thinking about that going back and I was listening to the stuff that you guys just put out, and I was trying to remember the show, and it was at Cafe du Soleil. Your guitarist Tim apparently has the memory. That's your Google guy right there, right? You always gotta have like one.
There's some memory on him. I boast having a pretty good memory myself, but he sometimes comes up with very obscure little tidbits from back in the day that I can't believe he even remembers. So,
In the Killjoy circle, it's Shelly, and sometimes Gene, but not so much Mike. Mike kind of, but that's Mike. But Shelly was just like, oh yeah, I was in a cafe, and then when you sent me the link, I'm going, vegetarian food. I'm like, they still sell vegetarian food after all this years.
It's a place on Commercial Drive here in Vancouver, and it was kind of a odd little spot for us, but I didn't care where it was. It could have been a McDonald's playing with the Killjoys, and I would have been all over it.
It was when that show went down, when I was tour managing the band was having a particularly long tour. It was getting a little long in the tooth. And we had a show at Prince George later on in the day, and leading up to it, it was like, you want to blow this out? I remember Gene going, hey, should we do this? Is there, what do you think? And I'm like, well, we've never been there, and it's an afternoon gig, and I mean, it can't be like horrible. I mean, you've done some horrible shows in your past, I'm assuming, playing around Vancouver with different people. There are some shows that go really bad, but when we rolled in there, it felt a little odd because here it was this little cafe, and then you see all these moms and their kids, and you see all the underage kids, and like, oh, we pulled up in a bus. We look like a bunch of dicks, And then we did the sound check, and then your band was playing, and I was immediately. I don't know if it dumbfounded is the word or flabbergasted, but I was just like, holy f, where did these guys come from? I mean, even like within the first couple of songs,
Really?
you
Well,
guys were like, and you were, how old were you then?
that would have been, my guess is around close to 97, if not 97, because we split up in 97.
But yeah, so it would be a couple of years before that, though. So how old were you guys as a whole?
I mean, we would have been no older than 21, I would
Yeah.
guess. 20, 21.
Yeah. And you guys were super tight. The vocals were unbelievable. And what I was telling other people, even after that show, for months and months and months and months afterwards, I was telling people about your band, going, there's this band that opened up. And they had I couldn't tell what was their material to popular material. And I meant that as a compliment at the time, and I still do to this day, because I could hear bits of Sloan, I could hear bits of Grapes of Wrath, I could see the posy tattoos that you guys had all up and down your arm sleeves.
Absolutely.
You could see that there was the whole posy thing there too. And when I talk about that stuff, I'm talking about that sort of like pop tune ear candy, but not like what it is today. So I mean, there was songwriting in all of it, all these great elements, and then there was this underlying big star kind of umbrella that was over top of everything, but I didn't get any of that like rock and roll kick screaming kind of Replacements kind of punky vibe to the band at all, which was popular
No,
back in that day.
yeah, and the closest we would have got to anything like that would have been Red Cross, right?
Red Cross, yeah,
We
another great band.
actually, the first song on the album, Verse 2, was a homage to Red Cross and the bands that we were trying so hard to get shows with, our heroes, right? And that song was written in the frustration of trying to, get into that the network, the crazy network of promoters and venue promoters that we were encountering at that point. I mean, we had some connections, we had some good shows, great shows, But you know, it's for some reason it was really tough to get in with those guys, the Posies, Sloan, Treble Charger, Killjoys, Red Cross. We, you know, Teenage Fan Club didn't come through at the time. That's all it took to fall over you. Can it hurt to know? I shouldn't be the one to show. Distorted feeling amplified. Can it hurt to know? I'll be the first one in the line.
All those bands, and you know, unless you, when you start into something, unless you know those people or you've been a part of the industry, you can greater understand how to get those shows. Mm-hmm. But you guys are young guys. You're from Vancouver. I don't know. I didn't hear any bands sound like you guys in that area. So I'm wondering how you guys developed your sound. Was it just from the influence of the music, or when you guys got together, that was it?
Well, basically, when we first got together in high school, the big band for us at the time, our heroes at the time, were the Grapes of Wrath. Yeah. You know, they were local boys that, you know, even the keyboardist at the time, Vincent Jones, he had graduated from our high school in small town North Delta, a suburb of Greater Vancouver. And so those were the guys that we, you know, them and I would say Blue Rodeo, but, you know, Blue Rodeo, less the country influence, but we chose some of their songs to play live. But it was mainly Grapes of Wrath for their harmony aspects and their songwriting aspects that we grabbed onto. And then, you know what it was? It was a Saturday Night Live episode that I saw Teenage Fan Club. And I remember it was Jason Priestley, and it was Teenage Fan Club that came on and played The Concept and Pet Rock and a few shows. And I remember going to school the next day and going to the guys, you guys got to hear this. I'm going to find this album. They're almost like, and I didn't know how to put my finger on it at the time, you know, power pop or Beatles-esque or, you know, but I said, they're kind of like Grapes of Wrath for the harmonies.
Yeah.
But they have these grungy guitars going on, and I loved it. And so anyway, got the album, and then boom, our entire network of friends and the band, we loved that album. And I think it was Tim who, through the Grapes of Wrath, learned of the Posies through a show at a local. You guys out in Ontario have the big, it's the PNE out here. It's the Pacific National Exhibition.
Right, yeah.
We roller have coasters and rides.
Yeah.
So he saw a show years previous. I think it was their Dear 23 album that they were promoting. And he saw them open up for the Grapes of Wrath. And so he had always had them in the periphery of his mind, but never, I don't think, had their album or listened to them. So then we, you know what? We learned this Teenage Fan Club. Let's get some Posies albums, and then Frosting on the Beater came out, and the transition was right there. That power pop just flew right there for us. But you're right, in Vancouver, there weren't really any bands that emulated that sound. There were a few that afterwards came out, Limblifter, you know,
one of the best all-time bands that ever come out of Canada.
Absolutely.
And safe to say, one of the craziest bands to come out of Canada.
Yeah. I remember seeing those guys because they were leftover guys from Age of Electric.
And, well, they were still playing at the same time. It was an Age of Electric project that they had together with the brothers duos, Dolls and the other one I can't remember offhand. And then as Age of Electric got signed, as the story goes, they ended up, one of the guys from the record company asked him, Brian, what else are you guys doing? And here's this other thing we got going. And so all of a sudden, there was two acts in Canada that were made up of the same people, but, you know, well, not the same people, but just two different sets of brothers touring.
Right. So aside from them, and another band that came through from out of the Limblifter lineup was, do you remember the Bloody Chiclets?
Yes, I do.
They had a hit song out there for a while. And
it was, Paste? Pluto or Paste or something?
Pluto.
Black Lipstick. Black Lipstick was the song.
Oh, okay, right. And Bloody Chiclets also had a hit, On and On. Yeah. And I can't remember the, anyway, so you're right though, a lot of the bands in Vancouver, and we would have known because we were trying to gravitate to those types, you know, to get shows rounded up together and try to get that scene going. Cinnamon was a smaller band about that time, but friends of ours to this day. But yeah, it's hard to, you know, and that's why we were so pressing, trying to get shows with the right guys.
Just because you follow me doesn't mean I'm there, and you will not be surprised. Find the way around, only if you dare. A starry image and reprise. But you don't need my will to hide it. You don't need
19 years old, just came out with our first CD, and our ridiculous management at the time got us a show with Black Diamond. Do you know?
Now, wasn't Black Diamond the ultimate tribute Kiss experience?
You got that right.
Yeah.
And so you got these 19-year-old bubblegum pop, power pop kids up on stage opening up for the Kiss tribute band.
So luckily, it's amazing.
Luckily, it was at a venue called the Vogue Theater right on Granville Street here. Right. A big theater there. So luckily it was a seated event and it wasn't, a rowdy sort of Kiss crowd that would have launched bottles at our heads.
Oh yeah.
So, the funny thing is that there's a little story there that, that came from the frustration of trying to get the right shows other than just buddies of ours trying to get up on stage and having some good shows. I mean, we were doing very good shows at the time. We were selling out the Town Pump, headlining on the weekends. We did have a show with Ginger, who were the Fallout guys from the Grapes of Wrath. So there were some good shows, but there was the frustration of trying to get more of that going in Vancouver. And anyway, that show in particular, as nightmarish as it would have sounded for us to open up for a Kiss tribute band, we had a good following and we had quite a few of us, our team there. And the show went really well. And in fact, at the end of our set, we were going off and we're just heading off stage to say, yeah, good show, guys. This was kind of cool. It was a really cool venue. And all of a sudden hearing the clapping in unison, going, we're not getting an, we're getting an encore here.
That's crazy.
Like an encore at a Kiss tribute show. Do we go out? And someone, I guess it was the stage manager, whoever it was, just said, yeah, go, you guys are having fun, go. So we get out there, we play, of all things, I think we played a Posies cover that nobody knew other than our, fans, right, and friends and family. So we get backstage afterwards and I forget the guys, I think it was Stephen Page and a few others. They were the ones who started the encore. The Bare Naked Ladies stood up behind our buddies and just, yeah, started the encore going. And then Sebastian Bach flies out of the dressing room. I guess he was in town doing something at the time from Skid Row and whatever project he was doing at the time. Can't remember the other Vancouver based band that he had something to do with, but he flew out of the dressing room with another Bare Naked Ladies member. And I think, you know what? Our moms and dads are waiting in the audience. We better get going before some trouble happens.
Great story.
Those are the kind, so we did have some fun. We had some great shows. And when you said that, you mentioned earlier, you must have had some of those nightmare shows. Really, I don't. There were a few of the shows where, you wish a few more people would have shown up. There were only a few of those.
Walk into the room, close the door, turn out all the lights.
era shows, we didn't have those. I'm sure if we started touring, you know, now and talking with the guys from the Grapes of Wrath, oh, there's Nightmare Stories. You get some of those small towns and they don't, well, they don't necessarily want you there.
This is why I brought it up, because to me, you can tell over the length of time that I've been around Canada, North America, doing shows back in the day, you can see the development of bands and how far they could develop because of their music community that they had. Some had scenes and they always changed, but some had like hardcore community where this is where you played and you played this next venue if you were doing a small jaunt anywhere. So I was going to do a follow-up question, like, did you ever make it as far as Calgary or did you get past Kelowna? Those kind of things.
We didn't get past Kelowna. The plan was as we were recording this album, Sucker Tree, in 96, and then in the beginning of 97, I believe, we started to get some label interest. Warner Canada, we were talking with them. We were talking with Network folk who were Grapes of Wrath and Sarah McLachlan and Skinny Puppy. And you know, so we started to think a little bit more seriously at that point. At least I was. Maybe the other guys were as well, but it was so close to the breakup that I wasn't unaware at the time that it was. But the plan was to eventually, you know, purchase a small little bus and pack it up and start, you know, get across, go all the way to, you know, Horseshoe Tavern and on the way back, right?
Right.
But that never happened. We split up. So the furthest we had ever got was Kelowna, which was always fun to play right downtown. But
yeah,
never did get to that point.
It's also the situation that you are in, like location wise, is great for just going down over the border towards Seattle and doing it as if, you know, because when we talk about touring and shows for bands, back in the day or even now, they're so far in between. It's kind of hard up here in Canada. Right?
Yeah.
States, it's just like, it's only the next show is only 20 minutes down the road. Here it's like, I got to plot a GPS. I got to figure out how I'm going to get from here to over to there, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because ever since we now released just here in the new year, Sucker Tree, 25 years later, now we're getting the requests because of social media and whatnot. Yeah. Come on down to Chicago, come down to Seattle, Oregon. We'll try our best to get some shows together. You know, and here we are. I mean, as great as that would be, you know, all of us have, or three quarters of us have family, kids, you know, wives and things to, and careers. That would be very difficult to pull away. I mean, maybe we can, you know, get ourselves together and do a fun show in Seattle and then Oregon and back quick. But but we are talking. Unfortunately, when we first got into mixing the album, COVID hit, and we hadn't had all four of us in the same room, you know, since 99.
I just want to interject here. When you look at something like the story on this, okay, so you break up 97, that sort of thing. You've done this album. Mm. It just sits. And then COVID comes around. And it's like, well, were there any inklings before the COVID to pull the tapes out of whoever's garage, the reels out of whoever's garage to listen to?
Yeah, you know what? It wasn't even a matter of listening to them, because they were unlistenable. They were just recorded ADAT tapes that, unless you had an ADAT machine to be able to split up those tracks and to mix it all together, it's really nothing. All you can listen to is the individual, you know, rhythm guitar, the snare, the tom, the bass guitar, the one vocal. You know, you couldn't listen to it as a song. And we only had a few demoed down before we split up back in the day. So really, and to answer your question, no, the answer was no. The technology wasn't there, first of all, to easily do this, to mix it down digitally and then, you know, get it done in this way, or even play around with our computers at home and listen to it even on a very rough mixed sense. So they just literally sat in a shoebox that I have a photo of it under my bed, a shoebox that sat in garages, various garages over the years. And it wasn't until I had, I got into a huge relationship change and my girlfriend, I had said, you know, this is who I am and this is who I was. And I was in a band and trying to explain some of the stories that I just told you. And, you know, you were. Now, where are the albums? Where are the photos? Where I had a few photos. I had an album. I couldn't even find the TV show that we were on. I couldn't find anything. So, boom, I get on the phone, emails. Hey, guys, haven't talked to you in forever. How about these tapes? Do they exist? Are they around? At least the demo, the few demos that we had. No, somebody's got the CD from, you know, Glimmer that we came out with in 95. Somebody's got that. Maybe ask my cousin. They might have a copy, you know?
Right.
So it was a real struggle to try to get anything, any memorabilia from our time. But, you know, I found a newspaper clipping and I showed her and okay, so this is legit. Now, Tim, where are these tapes? And he said, I think Enzo has them, our bass player. Asked Enzo. Nope, I haven't seen them. Oh no. They're lost. Yeah.
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 And then Tim found them in his garage. And I immediately start getting on the phone with every studio in town. Do you guys have an ADAT machine that you can transfer down into digital wave files? No, no, no. Couldn't, you know, I spent a week trying to find someone, even asking some industry folk. And finally, it took a guy at Long McQuaid that said, yeah, I got a couple kicking at home. I'll do it for you.
Of course he does.
Yeah, a couple $100. I'll do it for you. I'm like, oh, great. So we got those down. And until then, I remember sitting in a star. I picked up the zip drive, jump drive from the guy at Long McQuaid, rushed my butt over to Starbucks, sat there with earphones for the next 5 hours on a work day. I didn't care. You know, I own my own business. Sure. And I was just sitting there. I don't care what's coming through. I am listening to this for the first time in 25 years. And the magic that was coming through those earphones, even though it was the individual tracks still at that point, I couldn't hear it as a song, just the individual instruments and vocals, it all just flew right back. And I went, oh man, I have to get these things mixed down. I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I'm going to get it done. And that was the first. So really, we hadn't heard of it, heard any of the songs, anything. I'm sure there were thoughts at the time through the early 2000s of somebody saying, you know what, I wonder if this can get done.
At least for now, I break and cry. I will not be the one to show on time. Luxurious brow, reflect on tea. Till I forget.
life moves forward. That's what, and time waits for no one. Well, I'm very happy that you guys were able to put this all together again.
Yeah.
Did you personally mix everything down, or did you get an outside producer?
No. So in fact, I, now again, the magic of social media. Back in the day, it would have been a letter to DGC Geffen Record, the record label, to try to get in touch with someone at the Posies, you know. So through social media, I messaged John Auer, and again, I can't remember we had met a year prior at some show that they were doing in town, and I hung out with him for a bit. But anyway, regardless, we hadn't really chatted after that, not much at all. So I just sent him a message on Instagram and said, hey, John, we have this album. Do you do side projects still? Do you do anything? And he said, yeah, let me hear some stuff. And as soon as he heard it, he messaged back, whether he was interested in that or the money. He just said, sure, I'll mix it down. Absolutely. Yeah. So he had started the process. Unfortunately, it just wasn't going. It was sounding good, but I had a feeling, and I had a few friends, family members that mixed music, and they said, you know, there's a few things here that could sound better, actually, and not, you know, and maybe cheaper, you know, once the exchange rate went. So I got on the horn with a local friend of ours from high school that was, you know, he had been recording and makes a living doing his music. And I said, do you know of anybody? Oh, well, try out Evan Morgan. He mixes my stuff and produces, and you know, he's great. He apprenticed under, I'm sorry, I'm going to forget the name here. I think his last name is Lanny, Arnold Lanny. He was
Arnold Lanny.
Yeah, he produced all the Our Lady Peace albums.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, and the hit song with Sheriff back in the '80s, and
he bought that song.
Oh, really?
He ended up buying his own song back. And then it broke huge again, and then all the money came back to him, and then he could start up everything else again.
Well, yeah, truth be told, then he is I think he's in Temecula or somewhere my cousin, he was actually at my cousin's wedding, totally unrelated, just one of these connection stories. But anyway, so Evan Morgan had apprenticed under Arnold Lanny, and it shows, you know, the guy, you know, he's, I don't want to say he's starting out, but you know, I mean, he's not big yet, but he's getting some huge acts. A rapper in Canada, I can't remember his name now, that he's doing very, very well. And he happened to hitch on to him as an artist, mixing his stuff and maybe producing. But it shows, I mean, what he did with our old basement recorded 90s ADAT tracks, what he did with those to make this drum sound the way they do, the guitars, everything. I was really happy. I wouldn't have imagined us getting to that sound quality. I knew we could do a bit better than what John was doing, but to get to what we got, really, we couldn't ask for more. We were young kids recording in a basement, and we got that.
I told you the truth, told you the truth, told you the truth. I want you to show.
Never. What would a 19, 20 year old John think of the mix now? Oh,
over the moon, because at that time I had that vision. I had the vision, as I said, we were pushing for record label, major label interest. And I knew if we had the backing and a budget, we'd be able to get in the studio and do something really worthwhile. And I'm an audiophile. I love, even the Killjoys albums to this day, the sound quality on those recordings and mixes are, they stand up. But myself back then, that's exactly, I wanted, and probably even more, because I would have wanted to record them somewhere like Greenhouse Studios or some big mushroom studios or.
Right. So Evan does the mixes and then you guys go, okay, well, we're going to put this out.
Yeah.
Where does Future Records, is it Future Records or Future Man Records? Sorry.
Future Man Records. Yeah.
How do they discover? Is that you just going, hey, here's my stuff? Or is this another connection thing?
Yeah, no connection at all. And I was never a social media guy. I stayed off Instagram for the most part, and Facebook. I hadn't had a Facebook ever until a year and a half ago, or maybe now going on 2 years, a year and a half ago.
Sure.
Many years went there where I wondered where some buddies went from high school or what happened to this person. I hear that's mm-hmm. the way of catching up, but I just never did. Stayed away from it. So I quickly learned that there is a huge network for music, for musicians in both. And on Facebook, the Power Pop communities on Facebook, still going strong in their way. And, someone just reached out to me when the album got released, got it on Spotify. I put a few posts. Someone suggested I should put a post up in one of the Power Pop communities. And I did. And then boom, just, a flood of messages from various individuals. And Keith from Future Man was one of them, and said, hey, would love to put this out there as a CD, a physical release. I know you're on Spotify, but there are some interest out there for physical release. And and at this point it's all for fun. It's always just been for fun. As I said, we're now 46 years old with careers and families, and it's nothing but an amazing souvenir that we never had a chance to complete back when we were young. And now to show, I mean, I don't have children, but I can imagine the other three guys, just the joy it would be to show your family now, who are now are in their teens and not too far away from when we first started.
Yeah.
Just the joy in that. So it's been great. So in saying that, the album was never intended to be even released.
And here we are. You've managed to put this together and it's out there. So now you're acting like Johnny Hustle. When I say Johnny Hustle, it's like, okay, yeah. I got to be a publicist now. I got to be a social media marketer. But you just got Facebook two years ago. Super. Now you got to get into all these platforms. So, which leads me to doing this much hustle. What are you getting as a result of all of this? Because to me, the story of an album sitting there over 25 years, and then all of a sudden people hear it and it's amazing. What are some of the feedback are you getting from some of these different people in the field?
Well, getting initially just, wow, where was this? You know, where was this all these years? And how did this hold out 25 years to be released? You know, it's in a way a shame, but in another way, for those who crave that music, that style of music still, you know, it's a bit of a, I guess they're happy that it's come out. You know, they clearly reference the bands that we wore on our sleeves, and they can hear that through the music. And just like any music I would hear nowadays, and to be honest, I'm quite tired of new music that's coming out for quite a while now, that anytime I hear anything that reflects back on or sounds similar to the bands that we loved or the music that we loved, I you know, it gets stuck in my head right away, and I need to grab it, you know, listen to it, mm-hmm. which is rare for me nowadays to actually hear something for it to really have an impact for me in music. So I can imagine there's a lot of that. We're, as I said, we're getting some interest of, hey, yeah, you want to do a show eventually when COVID is over and this and that. Well, or play at this pop festival or, you know, and absolutely, I don't know logistically if it's going to work out. I mean,
it's not because I just don't care.
You're listening to The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
You're listening to Steel City Music.
The setup is so, like, the times are so different. If we had everything that now, back then, Underwater Sunshine to me would be super huge. There is no physical barriers of show to show to show. There's momentum that band at that time could have picked up, where not just, sure, you make it all the way to the Horseshoe Tavern, but you go all the way to Newfoundland and you go down to the States and you go to Europe, right? Mm-hmm. Because your style of music for that time and even now is still super huge amongst certain groups of individuals.
Yeah. Well, where the heck were you 25 years ago when we needed you?
Dude, listen, I'll tell you right now, John, I loaded the gear in, I helped set up the stage, I set up the merch, I did my bit, and I told everyone about you. That was my bit.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't have all this technology back then.
Yeah,
for sure.
No, of course. No, and I appreciate that. And it's you know, in saying that, the plan is to, you know, we are recording fresh right now in the process. It's a bit difficult now in summertime, you know, but we've already started the bed tracks of a song from back then that didn't make it onto these.
Those two tracks you've already recorded, there was on the latest one, there was actually just two tracks that are only digital that you're offering on Bandcamp. Now, were those done later what the band is now, or are those still songs that were from before?
Those are from the exact same sessions back then. When My Baby's Beside Me, the Big Star song, that was done when we heard there was a tribute album coming out for them. And we got in the studio originally to record just that one song, I believe, and maybe a few others. And then we said, hey, we've got a lot of catalog here of other songs. Why don't we stay in this studio and whip them all down? So we ended up recording about 18 songs in total. Only I think 13 of them ended up on Sucker Tree. But then after Sucker Tree was released, I had definitely wanted to mix down When My Baby's Beside Me, the Big Star cover, and Going On was an afterthought. It was that had got mixed down afterwards because I was sitting at home after a year of loving the process of this and mixing this entire album, that boom, it's on Spotify. Now what the hell do I do? I'm sitting here at home or working without that creative outlet, without the outlet, without that magic that I was feeling for the last year of being, you know, in the process of mixing. So I said, you know what? I'm not done. It was only not even a month after Sucker Tree was released digitally that I said, you know what? I'm going, Evan, you got time for me for another song or two? Yeah. All right. I'm back in.
Don't need to talk to my doctor.